Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
Our conversation on the life cycle of big cats continues with discussion on middle age and the challenges that face both wild and captive populations.
Now, in captive situations, is there a point at which then, even if the mother is to stay with the cubs, there's a point at which the cubs need to be separated away from the mom?
Usually, that's something that has to be observed. In institutions, zoo institutions, many times these cats are slated to be moved from institution to institution to further breeding programs. In the case of the sanctuary community, many times it's going to be an observational thing where once mom and daughter are truly not getting along, or perhaps there are some adverse psychological or social behaviors being shown, then it becomes important to try and separate them out.
And what you just said, true, is that in captive situations, many times they're even moved to entirely different zoos. Mm-hmm. So they're not even in the same zoo anymore.
Right, which effectively accomplishes the same goal of giving them different territory.
I'm sure this question comes to many people's mind is when you do have cubs that are all born in the same litters, and especially with a pride of lions, there's a lot of the same genetic material going around.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that the, brothers and sisters and cousins aren't all mating and causing all kinds of genetic defects?
Well, that's an awesome question. And when it comes to lions, there's somewhat of a built-in system because of the whole pride takeover thing. A resident male lion lives a very, I wouldn't say it's not a luxurious life by any means, but it is certainly a bit regimented. They are kings of the savannah, so to speak, but their entire purpose is protecting the pride from hyenas and other predators. It is marking the territory. It is making sure that the females, when they go into heat, are mated with. And so what will oftentimes happen is that they only can reside there for maybe 2 to 3 years. And if you do the math on it, that makes sense. If you've got a cub that is 3.5 to 4 years being kicked out, by the time that they are 5 and 6 and in their real prime, that other male lion is going to be getting older. He's going to be pushing up there into the 9-10 range and maybe even older. And at the point when the young guns decide that they're going to come and take over a pride, that will start the cycle all over again. And the cubs may be killed, and then it starts over. Now, when it comes to whether or not the males end up taking over the exact same pride, that's a whole separate issue and probably pretty rare just because of the amount of distance that has to be covered to stay safe from their original pride.
So you're thinking that that doesn't happen just because of that when once they're kicked out, they have to go so far away to be safe that they wouldn't come back and take over the same pride.
Right. And some of the best work that was done on this was done by George Schaller, who was one of the, I would say, fathers of lion research throughout the 60s and 70s. He did track a great deal of prides and watch these prides move back and forth and through the dynamics of the African landscape, and found that the males would generally start to take over other prides and not really their own as much.
But that did happen from time to time?
The possibility certainly arises, and even if they do take over their own pride again, there is going to be enough diversity, or at least there should be enough diversity, such that they will be able to mate with all the females and with any any luck, the cubs that are suitable will survive.
Even though some of those females may be related to that lion.
That is really more of a human convention. And in the world of big cats, especially in the world of the lions, if you've got a 1 in 5 chance, its survival of the fittest doesn't matter what womb it comes from.
Well, it does in genetics, though. If you have too much inbreeding, that's going to cause issues no matter what species you are.
Also true. But that's not the lion's concern. That's our concern. And it is very much our concern, especially as we have more and more bottlenecks that are taking place. I think of the cheetah is a fantastic example of what can happen if the bottleneck gets too severe, where you have a genetic group that is so similar that the breeding has to be extraordinarily careful to avoid the fundamental problems of inbreeding.
And we've talked about this in the past. The Florida panther went through that issue.
Another great example.
Yeah, we had just too few Florida panthers, and they started inbreeding. All kinds of issues started happening with their genetic material, and we had to bring in cougars from Texas to help change the genetic codes that were being passed on.
And as controversial as that decision was, it likely was the one that saved the Florida panther.
Correct, yes. So that obviously is, like you said, more the human game then as to whether siblings are mating, because to them it's just siblings are mating, and if it happens to be bad genetic material, it's not going to survive anyway. Now, what about in captive situations? Do you find that situation being an issue there as well, where the siblings may try to mate?
Absolutely. And the problem of inbreeding is one that's been discussed a number of times with captive tigers, not simply because of a human issue, but also because of an animal health issue. In the 80s and 90s and in the time frame when I would say that tiger availability really started to take off, there was a big impetus for people to try and have tiger cubs. It actually became an industry, a very strong industry. And
you mean as pets or?
As pets.
Okay.
Well, actually, all of the above. The pet industry is very interesting in that people generally will want the commodity, but it's no different really than the dog industry, whereby there are some people who want the purebred breeds and other people who are fine with a loving mutt, so to speak.
Right.
And the same thing takes place in animal breeding when it comes to the tigers. There were people who, like zoos and institutions, who breeding was extremely important for the genetic material, and others who just wanted a tiger. And it didn't really matter whether they were Bengal or Siberian. They were going to be huge. They were going to be striped. They were going to be fuzzy. And most people cannot look at a tiger and be able to tell them whether or not it is Bengal or Siberian.
Or whether it's a mutt at all.
They will be able to say, it's a tiger. And so inbreeding became an unfortunate evil of the need to produce cubs for the pet industry.
Now, some of those cubs ended up, for example, in sanctuaries like CIFAR. For example, you guys have a couple of cubs that are cross-eyed because of that kind of strange situation that nobody wanted them because they were cross-eyed cats.
And a great example of that one is Michelob. Michelob is possibly one of our biggest cats. He, as far as we know, was not inbred, but he is a white tiger. And some would say that by definition, all white tigers have to be inbred. And the reason for that, of course, is that the original white tiger, there was only one that was really in captivity that started in the 1950s in India. And through careful breeding through breeding period, they were able to produce the first group of white tigers, which were then given as gifts of state. So we know that all of that genetic material really had to start from there, because white tigers really hadn't been seen much in the wild up until that point. So fundamentally, that gene had to be shared amongst a bunch of different cats, and now a bunch of cats have the gene in an effort to try and get it out from that very insular original white tiger line. They've been bred with normal color tigers so that the normal color tigers can then breed with other white tigers or other normal color tigers with the gene. And then you just take your chances to see whether or not you get a white tiger.
So in some ways, that particular attribute couldn't have come out unless there was inbreeding.
It's possible. Genetic defects and birth defects are common in all species, but the white tiger is exceptionally susceptible to this because of its history of inbreeding and because of the intensity of the breeding that took place when all of the institutions, private and public, wanted to be able to say that they had a white tiger.
Okay, well, getting back to our original life cycle of the big cats kind of discussion. So we're at the point now where they're obviously beyond adolescence because they're at breeding ages now. And, you know, the captive ones and the wild ones, as you say, are breeding because hormonally, whatever they can find, they're going to breed with.
Yeah, it's almost like they don't have a choice.
Right? I guess some human males might say the same thing.
You know, it's funny you say that. There's research that's going into this concept of pheromones, and we know pheromones exist in nature. We see it happen all the time, but human females don't scent mark things, but they do scent mark themselves, i.e. perfumes and special shampoos, many of which are starting to be infused with what are being claimed to be pheromone products that will drive the guys wild.
Wonder if those really work.
Well, believe it or not, certain ones do. And one of the most common ones that I think affects all species is oxytocin.
Oxytocin? Haven't heard of that one.
Oxytocin has some very interesting properties. It is used medically to induce birth. However, in smaller quantities, they make it into perfumes and sprays, and it tends to cause a general feeling of well-being and trust amongst people. So if you go into a room and you spray oxytocin in the room, then generally speaking, that people are going to trust each other more and be more outgoing and open with each other. It's very interesting in that regard.
Oh, that's going to be started to use in big meetings of business, business deals. They're going to spray that into the room first.
It's a possibility, except it doesn't really last all that long, and chemically it is extremely unstable. So it can oftentimes be used as an antisocial anxiety drug for some people, made into a nasal spray so that they can give it a little sniff before they're going into a social situation that they're a little nervous about, and it allows them to be a little bit more outgoing.
That's pretty interesting.
And so this oxytocin may be a component of some of the pheromones that are sprayed by cats, which is one of the reasons why they spend so much time sniffing around for each other, and it draws them together.
Now, are you saying the males spray that, or do the females also emit that same thing?
It's likely that the females emit it. If there's one thing that I know for certain about tigers, especially tigresses, when they're in heat, they are going to be firmly in control of the pace. They are going to be the ones that have to convince the males that, yes, I truly am in heat. No, I'm not going to rip your head off. It's okay. Come hither.
So the women are in control, huh?
They are. And all the way through the act, all 20 seconds of it. And then when it's over very quickly. And the female is usually on her back, all teeth and claws, saying, all right, that's it. I'm done.
Now you better get away or I will rip your head off, right?
Exactly. And the males generally get the idea.
Is that true of all the big cat species?
That generally, that mating is very quick. It is very frequent and can be, I think it's been measured that some cats have mated 120 times in the course of a 24 to 48 hour period.
Wow.
Which would put anybody to shame, excepting the fact that it is extraordinarily short bursts, and then they may rest together. They are kind of dating throughout that time.
But they don't stay together, at least in the case of tigers, for actually rearing the children.
Not necessarily. And even in the case of lions, the sire may, of course, accept his cubs when they come back to the pride, but the mother goes off somewhere to have the cubs. The mother keeps the cubs in isolation for a couple of weeks until they're old enough to actually get to the pride itself. When it comes to the tigers, we know that the mother certainly will have some place where they're going to hide their cubs so that she can hunt and she can defend them. But it's been thought that tiger fathers will get involved to try to leave food or may do some meta protection of the area, not directly with the females, but might be a little bit more aggressive towards unknowns in that area.
So in general, the males aren't as involved with the rearing of the children in any of the big cat species?
Generally not, no. They are primarily to make sure that the species propagates, but from there, the ladies will usually usher them out of the picture.
That's pretty interesting, actually. Of course, we're killing the whole storyline for the Lion King, but that's okay too, I guess. So once they've gotten to that point where they're adults and they're on their own and they're out breeding and trying to find their own, in the case of lions, prides, in the case of tigers, just on their own, they still have to come together, obviously, to mate. And tigers are very solitary, so that whole process of being in heat has to be so strong to be able to pull the males from wherever they are to come in and mate.
It does, and this is the life cycle of the adult tiger, where they are intermittently hunting for food, defending territory, mating as necessary. But aging changes at this point. Aging actually changes in terms of how the cats start developing. So I'm sure you've heard the phrase, you know, dog years and cat years, right?
Right.
Ever wonder how you calculate that?
Yeah, that's a good question. How do they come up with that?
Well, if you're going to convert cat age to an equivalent human age, you usually add 15 years for the first year of life. So in the first year of life, they get to about an equivalent of 15 human years old. Then after that, you add 10 years for the second year of life. So the equivalent of a 25-year-old person is usually a 2-year-old cat.
Or dog, or...
This is predominantly for cats.
Predominantly for cats,
yeah,
okay.
This one happens to be for cats, the cat calculation. The dog one is slightly different. But after that second year, you add 4 years for every cat year.
Now, are you talking even domestic cats or just big cats?
It seems that they're pretty similar.
That's interesting in itself.
Okay. It is. And obviously the size difference is the part that is what's truly remarkable, because a domestic cat, when born, is very small and will double in size, in a couple of months and whatnot. But when you're talking about a tiger, you're talking about an animal that starts off at 1 kilogram and by the end of the year is going to be 50 kilograms.
Yeah, it's a pretty dramatic change, isn't it?
It's dramatic. It's amazing. So they're growing so fast. They're doubling in weight every week. That's a tremendous growth rate.
It seems like they have some major growth pains, too.
Well, they certainly must. I can't imagine what it must feel like doing that. It certainly lends them to a certain awkwardness. You'll see that the cat's paws are oftentimes much larger. They're oversized, floppy paws, because the paws don't grow quite as fast. I think it's probably because it's a more complex structure, and the plates, those separations that everyone's heard of, the epiphyseal plates, are going to be placed closer to the joints in the long bones. So it's easier for long bones to grow at that rapid rate than it is for the smaller bones.
Okay, so basically at the age of 3, based on what you just described, we're talking about an equivalent of like a 29-year-old human.
Yeah, roughly. You're a 28, 29-year-old human. And because these cats are outdoor, there is a distinction between indoor and outdoor cats for this, by the way, if you're doing this for your domestics. Your indoor cats do age slower than your outdoor cats. And since all of the big cats, generally speaking, are outdoors, I would wager that there is probably a calculation difference between cats in captivity and cats in the wild. That they're, because the cats in the wild tend to die so much sooner due to injury and illness and things like that, the cats of the wild are going to age faster than cats in captivity.
That's an interesting premise. So not that they're dying younger, but you're saying they're actually going to age faster in general as their life cycle span goes.
Right. And it's all based off of the equivalency, of course. But for example, if you're looking at a cat, you know, they say that a 7-year-old cat, if they're an indoor cat, they'd be 44 in human years. If they were an outdoor cat, it'd be more like 64.
Wow.
It's a dramatic difference.
So what's the lifespan of a wild cat versus the lifespan, now I'm talking about big cats now, mm-hmm. wild cat versus captive big cat?
Well, the oldest of the captive big cats can reach 25 years old, can reach 25 to 30 years old. That's, I think the world record was something like 28 years old, was the oldest, one of the oldest cats that were out there. In the wild, they are doing pretty well to last to 15.
Right.
And even as we have watched our cats age, and some of them have aged a lot more gracefully than others, there is such a thing as old-looking cats, and cats that you know, based upon the size that they were and the size that they are now, that they have lost a step. And in the wild, losing a step can be the difference between eating and not, living and dying.
So that's the next question then. So we've gotten to adulthood. We've talked about what their life is like as adults. At what point do they start slowing down and becoming what you might consider an old cat?
Well, there's going to be a number of different pauses in their life. And this is something that applies to humans too. I'm sure that you've heard of menopause.
Yes.
But have you heard of somatopause?
No.
Neuropause. There are a bunch of different moments in a person's life whereby their systems start to pause. Cycles that have gone for their entire life suddenly stop. The famous one, of course, being menopause that we mentioned, because that is the stopping of the female hormone cycle. However, there is also a point when neurologically you slow down the growth of neurons. It's a certain point where you slow down overall physical growth and your growth hormones go down. This is new and novel research that's taking place in the human realm and has massive implications for what that's going to mean for the animal realm as well. So the point at which cats start to age is largely going to depend on the point at which their systems start to change. And it can be extremely subtle. It can be something as simple as the gradual loss of hearing over time. And that one is extremely hard for us to comprehend because they have such a remarkable hearing range, up to 64 kilohertz. That's a whole octave above what a dog can hear. And if they start losing that, if they're only at, 60, 56 kilohertz, that's hearing loss. But we can't even fathom what that even sounds like.
Right. It's way beyond our capabilities.
Sure. And, other organs will start to go too. Visual loss, visual acuity will begin to go down. Especially with truly older cats, they will start to get cataracts. Or sometimes we'll see that overdeveloped tapetum lucidum, that membrane that's in the back of the eye, that they start to get really shiny, where they kind of get like a daytime blindness.
Oh, that's interesting. And can you actually perceive that they have this daytime blindness with the cats that you have?
Usually it will start off very subtle. And the most dangerous time frame is when they first start to have this attenuation in their senses. Because that means that whereas a cat previously might have started tracking you, from 20 feet away, suddenly you can get within 10 feet and they may not have detected you. And to them, you snuck up on them.
Right.
And so then they can become very jumpy and surprised that, what are you doing there? You weren't there a second ago. And I have always been able to tell when you were within 20 feet, and now suddenly you're within 10. And changes like that can result in tremendous behavioral changes too, because they're not going to make that linkage to say, oh, it's because my ears aren't working as well as they used to, or my eyes aren't working as well as they used to. It's you, Mr. Two-Legged, you snuck up on me.
Right. Somehow it's your fault, of course.
Somehow it's my fault. And because it's my fault, that can actually cause rifts of trust that you didn't even know were going to be built.
And beyond your control, unfortunately.
Exactly. And so as cats get older, sometimes you have to work with them, work with their senses, to make sure that you don't create an environment that's uncomfortable for them.
And doing research, you know, not only for domestic cats, for big cats, the kinds of things they go through aging is the same kinds of things we go through as humans aging. Like you've already mentioned, loss of hearing, loss of eyesight. They also have issues with more issues with cancer, with thyroid problems, with constipation, of all things. That's another thing that is common among aging cats.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously muscle tone and being able to move about, arthritis, diabetes. This list could be applied to humans as well. There's no difference really in the kinds of things that the cats are going through that us humans also go through.
Yeah, and that's the... That is the unfortunate reality. And they do have certain patterns which show up a little bit more in cat species. For example, when you think about, this is a dog-cat difference. When dogs get older, their needs change. Their nutritional needs change. They don't need as many calories to function. But with cats, their function still requires the same number of calories for some reason throughout their life. And that may be just the way that they're built. Maybe it has something to do with their innate ability to survive, that they still take in the same number of calories, but their body may not be able to process it the same way. They may not be able to process fats as easily, the really deep, thick, saturated fats. You may have to switch their diet to fats that are a little bit more amenable for them to digest. And that goes for small cats as well as big cats. That in younger years, where they may eat up a load of chicken wings and other meats, organ meats, suddenly they could eat that same meat. And if they're older, then they might not have it sit on their stomach as well, and they may vomit it up.
Well, I did read that you mentioned the change from fats to more proteins in their diet. That is a common thing for domestic cats. You do need to change their diet to those cat foods that are specifically for seniors, and what that is more proteins, less fats, and they also add vitamin supplements as well.
Yes, and the vitamin supplements can increasingly become both essential but also extraordinarily challenging. Cats have remarkable noses when it comes to being able to detect things and have a reputation as finicky picnickers. So it's going to be in their interest to continue to have the foods that they like. And they may not be willing to budge an inch. And with all of their lifetime of experience in eating, the second that they smell something that doesn't smell like what they're used to, then they will push it away and just say, that's just not right.
So giving them that supplement in form of a pill or something, for example, is extremely difficult.
In the form of a pill, you have a chance because you might be able to cover that in meat. But in some of these powders that are made, that can be extremely difficult because now you have to incorporate it into food and it's just diffusely through the entire meal. And just like with humans, you know, a good multivitamin is not going to come in a single pill because it's impossible to compress the quality and quantity of multivitamins into a pill that is also going to actually dissolve in your stomach. So the best, highest quality multivitamins come in capsules, and usually you have to take 2 to 3 capsules 2 to 3 times a day.
So you do actually give supplements to the big cats then, of some kind?
And we try to. And we have tried to, and they have systematically rejected many of our attempts to do so. And the way we've been successful is in capsule form. If we can find something that's in capsule form and hide it into a piece of meat that they really, really like that covers the sense, then maybe we can get it into them, especially if we stimulate their need to eat it fast as opposed to sniffing with it. But our cats are remarkable at being able to take a piece of meat and fully dissect every pill out from it. And drop all the pills onto the floor and then finish the meat and look at you like, gotcha.
So how do you get, you just mentioned getting them to want to eat it faster? How do you elicit that response?
Well, if you've got one piece of meat, then you can give them a small piece of meat and they'll recognize that as a small piece of meat. However, if you have two pieces of meat, or maybe you have three pieces of meat, and you feed them the first one and they're like, oh, that's great. And then you feed them the second one and show them the third, they'll recognize that they will get more if they can finish the second one quickly. So the impetus at that point is, okay, I already had one. That means I'm being fed. I'm going to quickly get this second one down so I can get to the third one. And it's the second one that may have the pill in it.
Right. So somehow you've managed to get them to eat the pill.
Right. You're just stimulating their natural instinct to get it down quick.
Tune in next week as we talk about the final phase of the big cat life cycle and the challenges inherent to both wild and captive populations.
C4 Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wilkes. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding.